Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How have U.S. diets changed in the past 70 years? Toward the end of the Great Depression, a New Deal program turned its attention and the talents of thousands of unemployed writers of the day to documenting how and what Americans ate. The project, called America Eats, divided the country into five geographic regions and was to have culminated in a sort of culinary guidebook to American culture. But it came to a crashing halt after Pearl Harbor and lay forgotten for decades until one of the country's most respected contemporary food writers stumbled across it in the Library of Congress. The fascinating newly edited book Mark Kurlansky created from the collection is called The Food of a Younger Land, a portrait of American food before the national highway system, before chain restaurants, and before frozen food, when the nation's food was seasonal, regional, and traditional, from the lost WPA files. Mark, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Will you start by talking about that moment when you found these essays and realized what you had?
Well, I originally became aware that such a project was attempted because Nelson Algren, who was one of the Federal Writers Project people, had written a long essay for it, which ended up in his personal papers and then ended up at the University of Iowa, which published them. So knowing how government works, I figured if there was a, everything in government gets dumped in the Library of Congress. So I just called them and asked, do you have this? And they said, oh, yeah, we got a pile of boxes. So I went there, and it was really, it was a wonderful feeling. It was like opening a time capsule into 1940 America. I mean, all of these manuscripts were on onion skin, remember that?
Sure.
Stuff, and carbon copies. And, you know, a lot of them had probably never been read, because what happened was, you know, the project was ongoing, and they had asked all of their over 4,000 writers all over the country to start gathering things about food. And, you know, they just started doing, you know, some did recipes and some gathered information and some wrote stories about banquets or different eating traditions, and there were poems. And then, you know, in this archive, there were correspondents, and you could see, you know, Pearl Harbor was attacked on December 7th, 1942, and these letters went out on December 8th and 9th saying, anything you've got, send it in now. Because they knew that the project wasn't going to be around much longer. And, you know, shortly after that, the people who were running it were removed, and it hung on for a while to do military training manuals, and then pretty soon it was gone. And the person whose idea it was, a woman named Catherine Kellogg, who also had the idea of having the Writers Project do guidebooks. There had been no guidebooks to America, and except one written by a Brit in 1909. And so she had the Federal Writers Project do all of these guidebooks, all 48 states and a lot of cities, and then she came up with this idea. And when she saw the whole thing collapsing, you know, she wrote these frantic letters and gathered everything she could and put it in the Library of Congress.
And she was quite a tough cookie from what you've described.
Yeah, she was apparently a very small woman with a very loud voice, and a successful woman, a very successful woman for her generation, who had left a pretty good job to work for the Federal Writers Project because she thought it was really exciting, and she saw that you could do interesting things with it. And she was really the ideas behind it. And the Federal Writers Project, you know, produced hundreds and hundreds of books that were got rave reviews from leading literary figures and were bestsellers. And some of them are still in print today.
Do you have the sense that the writers who participated in this part of the Writers Project, America Eats, were aware that they were sort of standing on the precipice of a radical change in how and what we ate?
I'm not sure of that. They knew that World War II was probably coming. I don't know if they saw, if they could see how much that was going to change everything about America. But they did have a sense that that America was changing, that just things like industrialization and there's this one of my favorite articles, and there's this rant about mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
And by this woman in Oregon who it's really a denunciation of industrialized food, that mashed potato would be anything other than a potato mashed. So she either saw what was coming or she was at least ahead of her time in her grievance.
Yeah, she didn't want anything squeezed through a tube or processed in some magical way.
Right, right. Whether she could foresee how bad it all was going to get, I don't know.
Can you give us a snapshot, and we won't go back to your exceptionally long subtitle, but what exactly, even the idea of America before frozen food is a really different place.
Yeah, it wasn't the exact, frozen food had been invented by Clarence Birdseye in the early 30s, but, nobody had good freezers. So there wasn't a lot of frozen food. And, especially not in homes. And it was kind of a new idea that hadn't been completely worked out. But, there weren't highways as we know them today. The national highway system that we know was built in the 1960s. And before that, there were, these little two-lane roads, which still exist, except that they're not main arteries anymore. When they were main arteries, they were full of restaurants because all of America was moving on them. But there wasn't a lot of plane, air freight, and food wasn't getting moved around, and people weren't getting moved around the way they are today. And so most people lived off of what was produced locally. Now, there's a movement today to do that, but it's optional. These people didn't, Americans in 1940 didn't do it as part of a movement. They did it because that was what was available.
So people in cities were shopping for food every couple of days, and it was probably grown within, as we talk today about local food, 100 or 200 miles of where they lived.
Yeah, and if you lived someplace like the Northeast, you put up food in October because, come November, there wasn't going to be much available fresh until April.
It strikes me, Mark, in reading this, that today, even when we travel to other parts of the country, it takes a special effort to eat anything different from what we get here in Dallas, Texas, or somewhere in the Northeast, or wherever we happen to live.
Exactly right. I mean, there actually is nothing in this book that I would be prepared to say doesn't exist anymore, because if I were to say it on the air, I guarantee you, you'd get a caller and say, well, I make that.
We're still eating possum, right.
Right. But what's different is that it's not readily available. It's not the normal common thing. I'm on a book tour right now. And, every time I go on a book tour, I wish that, I'm in a different town every day, and I wish I could eat something in each town that told me, that I was in a unique place with a unique food. That's very difficult to do now.
Who qualified for the Federal Writers Project?
Well, basically anybody who was broke. That was the main qualification, was that you had no income and you had no money.
So that was a lot of people at the time.
Yeah. So they got some accomplished writers. They got some young writers who, later became accomplished, like Saul Bellow and Richard Wright and
John Cheever,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Many more, but they also, it was a time like today when a lot of newspapers were going under. So they got newspaper people. They got editors and reporters and secretaries. And they really wanted the secretaries because, you know, typing was very important. You know, that was one thing that struck me looking at this archive. For example, there were things that were copied out of magazines and previously published things, and they were typed up. We forget there wasn't any photocopying. So, you know, a lot of typing. And there were teachers, and, you know, there were people who had always wanted to be a writer, you know, and they heard about this program, and they were broke, so they were in. And so these manuscripts had a very wide range of quality, and some of the worst ones I neglected to publish.
Well, what's interesting, though, is that you did make the choice not necessarily to take the finest bits of literature to have come from this project, but the most interesting.
Yeah, I wanted to give the reader the experience I had going through the archive, you know, the range of things. It was very striking in the South that this was the pre-civil rights South, and there was a lot of racism in the Southern manuscripts, and I included some of this because it's a part of, you know, what was there.
Yeah, some of that's hard to read because when they're describing, say, an African American person who gave them a recipe, they'll try to write this dialect, I suppose.
It's painful, and the conversation between the white person and the black person, and it sounds like the slave, the master talking to the slave, and they would identify these people just by first name, comma, a Negro. But a lot of those things would never have been published by the WPA, which was very socially conscious. Most of the stuff in my book would never have been published. If the WPA hadn't collapsed and America Eats had been published, it would have been very different. It would have been something that probably wouldn't be as interesting to us today as these raw manuscripts.
Because it would have been cleaned up.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But there were African-American writers, though.
Quite a few. I mean, Ralph Ellison and Zora Neale Hurston and Claude McKay and Richard Wright. And a lot of these writers were very nurtured by the Federal Writers Project. Books like Native Son were done, you know, while working for the Federal Writers Project, you know, and they're encouraged to take time off and work on your project. Some of these projects became, you know, major pieces of American literature.
Of course, Zora Neale Hurston had sort of two strikes against her in that she was African American and she was a woman. And
yeah, that was the story of her life. I mean, it was just amazing. She was probably the most qualified person that the Federal Writers Project had. The time she started working for them, she had already published three books, which put her way ahead of Saul Bellow or Nelson Algren or any of those people, including a highly respected novel. And she had a prestigious degree from Columbia University in anthropology, which was one of the places for studying anthropology. And Margaret Mead was one of her classmates. And here was this person who was eminently trained, to be going around and collecting this information, and also was a prominent writer. And the head of the project, Henry Alsberg, was a fellow Columbia graduate, and she went to see him, and he was very excited to get her on the project.
Let me stop you there for a second, Marcus. We need to take a break. We'll be back in just a minute with Mark Kurlansky. His new book is called The Food of a Younger Land. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is award-winning food and culture writer Mark Kurlansky. His new book is called The Food of a Younger Land. If you'd like to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Before the break, Mark, you were talking about Zora Neale Hurston and the fact that by rights she might have assumed that she was going to be managing one of these projects, but instead was sent down to Florida. And
yeah, well, she was from Central Florida, rural Central Florida, and you know, and Alsberg thought, you know, this is going to really put the Florida project on the map. Send her down as a supervisor, and so she went down there, and the project in Florida wanted no part of having a black woman in a responsible position, and gave her the lowest rung job, and she didn't seem to mind because she loved anthropological work, and you know, she just hiked off into Central Florida there and with a tape recorder, which probably weighed about 50 pounds. And you know, there's a number of letters in there. Where is Zora Neale Hurston? And let's talk to Zora. Where is she? You know, she did. I have one piece that I was able to find of hers. There's probably more. You know, there may very well be all kinds of other things that were written for this project that didn't get sent into Kellogg, and so they didn't end up in the Library of Congress. I have a number of things that weren't in that archive. I found a whole separate archive of New York things when I was writing my my book, The Big Oyster, about New York City oysters. I discovered that the America Eats New York things didn't get to Washington. They were dumped with another failed project called Feeding the City, and were in the municipal archives in New York. And, you know, there's probably other stuff around that I hadn't found.
How curious were Americans about different kinds of food in the 30s and 40s?
Well, you know, it was a much less diverse country than it is today. The 1920s and 1930s it was a period in which immigration was very tightly restricted. You know, so you don't have the variety of food that we know in this country today. You know, there isn't any Asian food. There's this very interesting piece from an Italian-American in Vermont, and there were a lot of Italians in Vermont because they worked in the quarries, and they apparently had this tradition of getting together to have Italian food, and she was writing about that, and she talked about ravioli, and then she explained to the readers what ravioli was. That's a different America. I think most Americans today know what ravioli is.
You know, it's interesting. I was reading this and thinking about in the early 80s, my parents moved with us from Long Island, New York, to El Paso, Texas. And we hadn't realized that things like deli food and bagels weren't American food all over America until we got to this place where we couldn't find it.
Yeah. When I was a kid in the 1950s, we used to travel all over America. I come from New England, you know, and we just did the whole thing to the West Coast and back. And in this huge Buick, that we were six people, fit comfortably in this giant Buick. You know, I remember that the food would just change everywhere you went. And I was particularly fascinated by some of these things, like Mexican food in the Southwest. I mean, there was no Mexican food anywhere else. And I remember eating my first taco on Pismo Beach in California.
Huh. Well, and what's really ironic in some ways is that some of those regional foods, now there are probably better restaurants in a lot of places, local restaurants, but at first some of those regional foods came about because of food industrialization and chain restaurants, which I don't think you want to count Taco Bell and things like that, but that was the first experience people had it initially.
Yeah, and you know, industrialization has done a lot to get this food around. I mean, tortillas used to be made by, you know, grinding corn and patting them, you know, patting the masa together with your hands. And not many people knew how to do that or were willing to do that. In the 1960s, they developed a tortilla machine. And you know, that's what got Mexican food all over the country.
Some of the things that I like the best in the book are these vicious fights that people have over the right way to do things. The only good baked beans are the way your mama used to make them.
Yeah, and Catherine Kellogg had encouraged that. She specifically asked that they find these food controversies. You know, like the proper way to make clam chowder is still very much argued about in New England. There was a big conflict over the correct mint julep.
And, yeah.
You know, it's right that people should be passionate about these things because it's their heritage and their culture.
And I guess now these debates are all sort of playing out on the internet where people write about recipes that they've made and how they should be made, but they're not so tied to place as they used to be.
Yeah, well, we're not so tied to places as we used to be.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I come from a fairly large family, and, you know, nobody is in any of the places they were at when I was a kid. I had a huge family in Boston, and I don't have a single relative in Boston today. And, you know, I think that's true of most of us. So we aren't rooted in these places the way we used to be.
One thing that was really interesting is occasionally you would turn up some information about a delicacy somewhere that was not local at all. For example, people in Montana, I think it is, developed this taste for eating dried seaweed.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and part of that is a function of how this thing was proceeding. You know, they had all these thousands of writers, and they were just told to, you know, go out and see what you can come up with, you know, and they would, you know, just, they came back with all sorts of things. I like the Coca-Cola parties in Georgia.
Yeah, and this would be, I guess, young girls would have their friends over and serve everybody Cokes.
Coke, yeah, for the novelty of drinking Coca-Cola, I guess.
Yeah, because at the time it would have been mostly drunk at a soda fountain, right, instead
right.
of at home?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Were you tempted to try and replicate any of the recipes that you came across?
I did in a few cases, and there's other things I would like to, try. I made a, Indiana persimmon pudding, which was nice.
Yeah. And they also made beer out of persimmons?
Yeah, that's not Indiana. That's in the South. They made beer out of, persimmon leaves. Both the leaves and the fruit in Indiana were it was a native persimmon, which you know, a lot of the persimmon we get today is an import from Asia, but there is a Native American persimmon, and you know, it's an example of you know, how regional food works. You know, persimmon is produced in about two counties in southern Indiana, and they still make persimmon pudding in those counties and have an annual persimmon festival. And even in Indianapolis, most people don't know about this.
There's interesting insight here, too, into the way people used alcohol at the time. Certain pockets of the country, people were drinking up a storm. This was not too far after the repeal of prohibition. And in other places, they didn't really drink a whole lot.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot about alcohol. And I think, you know, this is, you know, 8, 9, 10 years after the repeal of Prohibition. And I think there was still a real mystique and an excitement about alcohol. And all of these alcohol-making traditions that they're writing about in these manuscripts had been done, you know, illegally in the past decade.
What I love about that, too, is that except for, you know, hobbyists today and maybe people who are getting into these make-your-own-wine places, there's almost no one who regularly makes their own spirits. That all comes from a distributor somewhere.
Right, and that's partly because it's illegal.
But people, I mean, back then, it may or may not have been illegal, but they had their own ways that they'd been doing it. It sounds like even before Prohibition, and this is just the way it had always been done.
Yeah, I mean, these things go back to colonial times. You know, a lot of the food traditions in the East do go back to colonial times. And, there's also some very interesting pieces in there by anthropologists who studied American Indians, and you know, there were a lot more traditional tribal Indians around in 1940 than there are today, and. And also African American traditions. You know, there were still people around who had been born slaves, and there were people in the West who still alive who had come in wagons.
Mark Kurlansky is my guest. His new book is called The Food of a Younger Land. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Len in Dallas who says, your previous books, Nonviolence and 1968, were fantastic and have a permanent place on my bookshelf. These seem to be a major deviation from your historical writings on food, so I'm wondering if you would talk about the connection between food history and world affairs, and especially the connection or lack thereof to nonviolence. Is it something you've thought about?
It's funny because, you know, when those books came out, people were saying the reverse. They were saying, well, these books don't seem to be anything like Cod and Salt. Well, I mean, my whole interest in food is that it is a great anthropological tool that, you know, you can learn so much about a society and its history by looking at the food people eat. And that's what really motivates me to write about food.
You have a great submission in the book of food superstitions that was put together in Colorado. Can you talk about some of those?
These were really kind of mystical things. And, you know, part of the deal with these manuscripts is you don't know if these beliefs were widespread or if, you know, somebody from the Federal Writers Project, you know, ran into somebody in a bar one night and he told them these things or... But they're, you know, they're certainly interesting, and you know, there are a lot of food superstitions everywhere.
Things like good luck, black-eyed peas on New Year's Day, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Did the project lend itself to people seeking out the most extreme examples of food culture, even at the time?
It did, because you know it. I don't remember how many there were. You know, at one time there were 6,000 writers on the Federal Writers Project. It was by the time this one came along, I think it was down to 4,800 or something like that. But there were a lot, and you know, they got kind of competitive about trying to get into the book, and so people just kind of, you know, they ran around looking for wild and interesting things, and you know, things that the other guy wouldn't have. There's also the way the book was going to be designed is it was going to have these five big essays, and these essays were going to incorporate all of these manuscripts, so that most of these manuscripts would have never seen the light of day. But with each of these big essays, there were going to be two small pieces. And you can see by looking at the manuscripts that people really wanted to be the author of one of these small pieces because they were the only bylines that were going to be in the book. And, you know, people went over the top on some of this stuff, you know, some of the poems and short stories and people trying a little too hard to be literary.
Yeah, tell us about the wiener poem.
Oh, Nebraskans eat their wieners, yeah. What a great contribution to American literature. You know, if it wasn't for me, probably nobody would have ever known about this.
And we might have been okay, but it is
right.
It is really funny.
It's very much a Midwestern sense of humor, too. I went to college in Indiana, and, you know, Midwesterners have this wonderful, ironic sense of humor about themselves and about the Midwest.
Did you have the sense that people were trying to sell their food ideas even to the writers who came and interviewed them?
Perhaps, yeah. In some cases, certainly. These manuscripts came about from a variety of things. Some of them were just byproducts of other federal writers' projects, things that they had worked on. You know, I remember when I was doing the slave narratives that there was this guy I was talking to in northern Mississippi who had said something interesting about chitlins or something, you know, so that we'd go up there and talk to him again. And it was all kinds of different things. And, this is a sampling of some of the most interesting. And I have to say there were some things that weren't interesting at all.
People in the South were making vast quantities of barbecue sauce. I had to look over some of the proportions multiple times.
Yeah. It's and also cooking up a lot of meat.
Yeah, whatever moved, I guess they
right.
they would kill and eat.
Right.
And
there's an interesting thing there about I think from the Texas project about a chuck wagon. And,
yeah.
Not at all. Well, you know, you're going to get people from there correcting me on this, but not at all what we Easterners think a chuck wagon is.
Yeah, can you talk about the menu on this thing?
Well, it was a lot of innards and things. It wasn't really about steaks. It was really about those parts that used to be eaten locally because there wasn't a market for them.
Uh-huh. That's what the cowboys got.
Right, exactly.
Mark Kurlansky is with us. He's a food and culture writer. His new book is called The Food of a Younger Land. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Mark Kurlansky is my guest. His new book is called The Food of a Younger Land. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. I just could not get off reading the many, many strange descriptions for food from lunch counters in the New York area. This kind of slang that you see in movies and on TV shows really existed, apparently.
Yeah, it did, and I mean that's something that is gone. That whole New York lunch counter culture is gone. And, weird distortions of language.
It seems almost harder to have memorized all this than to just have said what it was that people wanted.
Yeah, I mean the real words were easier. I don't know. But it was, subcultures always mark themselves by creating their own dialects.
And even the culture of sitting down to lunch at a drugstore was a special thing that you had to sort of understand before you could fit in properly.
Yeah, that's something I miss. Those were great, and just going to a counter for a sundae at do they have those places anymore? I don't know.
There's one actually in Dallas, but it's sort of a novelty, I think, in and of itself. But it's been there for decades.
Right. Well, that's what happens with a lot of this stuff, is that there'll be either one survivor or somebody who, out of nostalgia, creates one, and it will become kind of a fashionable place because it's the only one, but it's not a part of our lives anymore.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Nancy in Fort Worth. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. My question is about the shift in the way food was advertised, I guess. I picked up a magazine from the 50s one time, and it had this most disgusting recipe of Jell-O gelatin with Hunt's tomato sauce, horseradish, and a dollop of mayonnaise on top. And this happy family's around eating this thing that looks like a volcano. And it seemed to be more about a company making money than really people eating well.
Yeah, and they were. They were put out by, you know, food industrialists to sell their products. And some of them are hysterically funny. And, you know, one of the famous classic ones was put out by Crisco. It's called The Story of Crisco. They have a rabbi. They quote a rabbi saying that, you know, the Jewish people have been waiting for 5,000 years for this, you know, kosher fat. Jell-O, which probably did the one that you're talking about, because Jell-O did a lot of them and had these horrendous recipes.
Yeah, well, my grandmother used to make something called tomato aspic, which sounds a little bit like that. It was kind of like a tomato Jell-O thing.
Right. I mean, it has to be said before we get too nostalgic about the food of the 1940s that there were some things that we could be happy about the disappearance of.
And the tradition,
do you remember you'd go to a restaurant and have a glass of tomato juice as an appetizer?
Yeah. With lemon squeezed into it? Yeah. Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Larry in Dallas. Hey, Larry.
Hello. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
So I'm just interested. Now when I read about food, it seems like that people are very almost obsessed about the healthiness of the food that they're eating. Yeah, this is low sodium. This is low fat. This is low calorie. Did people care about the healthiness of food in this writing? And if so, what constituted healthy food to them?
Well, there is a manuscript here from Los Angeles about how people in Los Angeles are obsessed with health food trends and how they'll eat anything, no matter how weird, if somebody convinces them that it's healthy. So, you know, this stuff was definitely around then. But, of course, they used to also unabashedly eat some wonderfully unhealthy stuff, especially in the South where they really know how to appreciate pork fat.
Pork fat and poke salad was something that I had only heard about in that song and never really knew what that was.
Right, right. I like this recipe from Kentucky for wilted lettuce. what a great counterintuitive concept, you know. You take fresh lettuce and you wilt it by putting hot fat on it.
Yeah, there's a remarkable amount of recipes in the book that call for drippings, which I guess people would save their meat fat.
Right. Right. And, you know, drippings are great stuff. Unfortunately, it'll kill you, but, you know.
Tastes good going down.
Right.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Nitty in Plano. Hi, Nitty.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
It's a great show coming up, and I'm enjoying listening to the food trends in America.
Thank you.
My question is, I come from India where majority of us are vegetarians, 100% vegetarians. So I want to know whether there was any vegetarian food culture in America or is it a recent trend which is picking up? I meet a lot of friends in Dallas area who are though white people, but they're still 100% vegetarians.
Yeah, no, a vegetarianism has been around throughout American history. It was very fashionable in 18th century England, where a lot of American food started from.
What was the reason for it back then? Was it health or political reasons?
Mostly health. Sometimes it was political. There was a very strong tradition of it, particularly in England. And in fact, Gandhi, the very restrictive diet that he went on was actually something he learned not from Hinduism, but from British vegetarians.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to J.D. in Dallas, who wants to talk not about vegetarian food, but about jackrabbit chili. Hey, J.D.
Yes, I'd like to pass that on. Coming from Texas and eating food that we had to eat that was necessary, we found ourselves eating a lot of various kinds of foods.
And
a friend was a cookie on a ranch, and he was really a good cook. He could cook around out there with a log fire, and he could cook a lot of things. So he would cook us up a big pot of jackrabbit chili. It was good. It just like, of course, chili is the history there. It was always made out of poor meat. It was born in San Antonio from chili makers there, but it was always poor cuts of meat. And so, Buddy being a cookie, he knew how to make it, and it was good.
Now,
a jackrabbit is a hare, right? Not a rabbit.
I think we lost JD, but I think you may be right about that, which means not a lot of fat in them, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And larger.
Yeah, and I guess the idea with those is that you cook them all day, these kinds of dishes, and therefore a poor cut of meat is palatable.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Was there a great sense, as you look through this, of people trying to make do in the Depression with poorer food than they would have had even a couple of decades before?
Yeah, absolutely there was. And it shows in a number of ways. A lot of game that was about going out and shooting some food because you couldn't afford to buy it. Squirrel and possums and things. There's a recipe for mountain lion, which is kind of shocking. But also there are a lot of recipes in which the ingredients are really limited to inexpensive things. There's a chowder from Maine that's just made with potatoes and, no fish or clams or anything. And there's a cake without much of anything in it called a depression cake. And it's something that we're starting to see today that you saw a lot of in the 1930s is that people would come up with and publish in newspapers recipes for making things in very low-cost ways.
Were you able to interpret all of the measurements and things like that? It wasn't that long ago, but I'm wondering if people talked a lot more about a pinch of this or a handful of that than they do now.
In some cases they did. And also, these recipes were taken down by people who were, to say the least, amateur food people. And, sometimes the recipes have important things missing. I noticed on the recipe for the Indiana persimmon pudding that it says to add milk and doesn't give you any idea how much milk you're supposed to add. But, if you want to try doing some of these recipes, that's part of the fun of it is you got to do a little. It takes a little creativity and imagination.
I think it's one of the Eudora Welty pieces that talks about cooking something till it's about done, and then you do this, and I guess you're just supposed to know what that means exactly.
Yeah. I like Eudora Welty's recipes a lot. I like her mint julep recipe.
Yeah, and she's the one who says you can never ask for anything better than what she's just given you.
That's right. I like the woman in Virginia who talks about all of the local specialties you can get along Route 1 in Virginia. And if you're not satisfied with them, you should just go up and knock on any door along the highway and complain, which I don't see happening along Route 95.
Let's go to Brenda in Dallas. Hello, Brenda.
Hi. I have the funniest little book that I found digging around in my grandmother's things years ago that was published by the Department of Agriculture, I believe, in either the late 40s or the early 50s, and it was given to my mother when she married my father by Congressman George Mahon, and it's this very politically incorrect little recipe book now that's seems to be based on the nutritional guidelines that were when they were first devised. It has this cute little picture of a woman in heels and a dress and a ruffled apron on the front of it, and how to it's sort of a how-to book to cook for your family and meet their nutritional needs. And I just wondered if you knew anything about these.
Yeah, I'm not sure. This was a government-published thing?
Yeah, she thinks maybe the Department of Agriculture.
Yeah, well, the Department of Agriculture did put out a lot of those things. I collect all these little things when I find them. They're great, but the the government ones always have some sort of an axe to grind. The corporate ones are just, purely about selling a product. My favorite of these little recipe books is a book called How Great Chefs Use Marshmallows.
Not at all, if they can help it.
Right.
Have you given any thought, Mark, to what a project like this, were we to start one today, might cover?
Well, yeah. I mean, it would be a good thing to do. I think we would, this idea that Catherine Kellogg and a lot of other people had in the 1930s that it was time to take a look at America. I think it's probably time to take a look at America again, and I think that we could learn a lot. Food writing tends to be largely focused on restaurants, and especially expensive restaurants. And you don't really learn a lot about the society and the culture that way. I would love to know more about what Americans are eating in their homes. I live in New York City, where I'm one of the last few people who still cooks. It's really amazing. But it would be interesting to know about these things.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what people do, what families eat when they get together.
Mark Kurlansky's new book is called The Food of a Younger Land. It's available now. Mark, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it was very nice talking to you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.